Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 11th of June. 25 million Americans, one out of every five adults younger than 65 with health insurance, didn't have sufficient coverage last year to shield them from financial hardship if they ended up in the emergency room or were seriously ill. We're looking at a recent study. Very recent. It was released yesterday by the Commonwealth Fund. It says that the number of people in America who have health insurance but not the ability to afford adequate medical care is going up. The sharpest increase in the underinsured middle-class families whose coverage left them vulnerable to medical costs equal to 10% or more of their incomes. The underinsured frequently choose to forego necessary medical care. Twice as many people who are underinsured said they didn't fill a drug prescription or see a recommended specialist for care compared with the number of people who had more generous coverage. Dr. Helen Halpin is with us now, joins us from time to time to talk about the healthcare crisis in this country. She is director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and will welcome phone calls. I would imagine that you'll be able to fill out this story with your stories of being underinsured or maybe uninsured. We've done many shows on that, but not as much on underinsured. Have you had to forego prescription drugs or treatment from specialists because your insurance coverage just isn't very terrific? Or has the price of your copay gone up significantly in the last few years? And then, of course, the big question is, what do we do about all of this? Dr. Helen Halpin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We haven't focused very much on the underinsured, and it is, when you look at this study, the number has gone up remarkably in the last few years, hasn't it?
It's staggering. For the last few years, we've been talking about an estimate of maybe 15 to 16 million underinsured, and that was based on their prior work in 2003. And this jump to 25 million is shocking. And I think even more alarming is the fact that it's crept up into the middle-income population, that people making $40,000 a year or more for their family income, the rate of underinsurance has more than tripled. So in 2003, about 9% of those low to middle income families were underinsured, and that has jumped to 27%. It's just shocking.
27%?
Yes.
Wow. What does it mean to be an underinsured?
Well, they define it a couple of ways. It's a technical term, and what it means is in the last year, you had insurance coverage, but you spent more than 10% of your total household income on medical care because of gaps or inadequacies in your coverage. There's a second definition, and that pertains to your deductible, which is the amount that you have to pay before your insurance kicks in. And we've seen these deductibles rise, and they define an inadequate deductible as one that is equal to or greater than 5% of your total income. And we see these high deductible plans becoming more and more prevalent and people choosing them because they are the only plans that are affordable. But affordable coverage doesn't mean adequate coverage, as these data are making very clear.
Right. So who are the people who are doing okay in this healthcare world? Is it people who are working for large corporations for the most part?
Yeah, actually, it's people who have employer coverage are still pretty well off. And it's interesting that I know the press reported that people in smaller firms are more likely to have these plans, but the data actually show that the rates of underinsurance really don't vary by the size of your employer.
Mm.
So if you have employer coverage, chances are you're in pretty decent shape. The two groups that had disproportionately high numbers of uninsured were, surprisingly, the non-elderly who have Medicare benefits, so those who probably are disabled or on SSI, and those who are purchasing coverage in the individual health insurance market. So they're not eligible for public programs. They don't get it through their work, but they've gone out into the marketplace to buy it for themselves or their family. And those are the policies that are likely to have a lot of these benefit limits and these high deductibles.
And those are very expensive plans, too, aren't they?
Well, it varies. I mean, the higher your deductible is, the lower your premium.
Mm.
For example, my son, who's 26, before he had a job that allowed him to go to get coverage through work, was buying on the individual market, and he bought one of these high deductible health plans. Mm-hmm. I think it was a couple thousand dollars deductible, and he got four visits, I think, outside that, and it was about $150 a month. So as far as insurance premiums go, that's pretty low. Right. I know it doesn't sound low, but it's for someone with a middle income, that's doable.
Right. And he stayed healthy, I hope.
Yes, fortunately, he didn't have to use it.
That's good.
See, that's the other. This is the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to understand that this is not describing the whole problem. There are many, many more people who would be underinsured if they got sick. This number of 25 million just happens to be those with inadequate coverage who got sick last year. And in fact, we find that the rates of underinsured are highest in those who are sickest. If you have a chronic condition, if you have a pre-existing condition, if you have, you know, fairly poor health status, you are much more likely to find yourself defined as underinsured, because you're going to need medical care, and when you need it, you're going to find that it's not adequate.
The author of the report said, and this is really hard to believe, we're moving in a direction where you can be insured all year and still face medical bankruptcy.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. I mean, if you have a high deductible and then you have coinsurance, 25-30% coinsurance on drugs or hospitalization, you just need one hospitalization to throw you into bankruptcy, even with full insurance coverage. The problem with the marketplace right now is that the costs are going up, and the only way that people are finding to control the government to control its costs, or for companies to control their costs, and in the individual market to be able to afford policies, is to increase the premiums, increase the deductibles, increase the cost sharing, and continue to push more and more responsibility for the cost onto the patient, when the patients who need insurance most become just completely vulnerable, both to delaying care, and not, it's a public health crisis, because these people are not getting preventive care. They're not going to get the care they need when they need it. They're not filling their prescriptions. So it's a public health crisis, and it's also a financial crisis, because the number one cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. has been medical care costs.
Hmm. So the people who are underinsured aren't filling drug prescriptions or seeing specialists because they would have to pay for that out of pocket?
It's because of the cost, yes.
Really?
And that's what they say. They say, no, they're not getting this care due to the cost.
Hmm. What are we doing about it? Is it affecting
some? Well, right now we're not doing much about it. I think the timeliness of this report is significant, because we are in the midst of a national conversation, I think, which will only continue to grow, about the need for federal action. And as you said at the opening of the show, most of that discussion has been around the uninsured. But this underinsured population is just as important. And, in fact, they were the subject of Michael Moore's movie last year, Sicko.
Mm-hmm.
All those folks that he portrayed as going bankrupt and not getting adequate care actually had insurance. And I think this is a cautionary note, because we don't want to extend lousy insurance to everyone. We will have accomplished nothing. I think it speaks to the importance that everyone have comprehensive health insurance that protects them when they're well and when they're sick, regardless of their income. Your income should not be a driver of what health care you have access to. And I think that many of the plans that we're talking about define these minimum benefit plans, these high deductible health plans. Massachusetts has one. California proposed one in its failed effort. And I think extending lousy insurance to everyone is absolutely the wrong way to go. And I think everyone needs to let our politicians know that everyone wants comprehensive coverage, not just new comprehensive coverage for the uninsured.
Elizabeth Edwards has been pretty outspoken lately on those people who have pre-existing conditions, and
yes,
looking at the president's and their plans. She was saying that not only would she not be able to get health care under his plan, that he wouldn't be able to get health care either because of his pre-existing conditions.
Yes, both John McCain and Elizabeth Edwards have cancer. I mean, if they went out into the individual market to try to buy health insurance, my guess is they couldn't buy it, or they'd find a policy that excluded treatment for the one thing they need it, which is their cancer.
Hmm. And she was noting a recent study showing that nearly 9 out of every 10 people seeking individual coverage on the private insurance market never got it. 9 out of 10.
No. Well, it's completely unregulated. The only group of people that's guaranteed coverage in the individual market are pregnant women. And even for them, there's no limit to the price they can be charged. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, an insurance company can exclude you for any reason they want. If they don't like the way you look, if they don't like where you live, if they don't like something that's happened in your past. We even had a nanny who couldn't get coverage because she had had a teenage pregnancy, and she had had the baby and given it up for adoption, but she couldn't get insurance because of that. I mean, it's shocking.
Oh, my.
It's shocking.
It is shocking. Why do we put up with this? It is affecting, obviously, as this report shows and others have before it, it affects so many people.
Well, it does, and I think that Senator Barack Obama, as the presumptive Democratic Party's nominee for president, has made a commitment to begin to work on this his first year in office. I know that Senate staff are already working to try to translate his proposal into legislation so that something can be done very quickly should he be elected president. And if, in fact, enough Democrats can be swept into the Congress in the fall, perhaps we can actually govern and pass universal health insurance. From my perspective, we have the best chance to do that in the next year than we have in my lifetime. So I remain optimistic that we can do something about this problem, but I think the important thing from this study is to make sure that we not just assume that everyone who has insurance is okay and we need to just take care of those who are uninsured. The reality is that a huge proportion of the population, I mean, listen to this figure, 72% of adults with incomes less than $40,000 a year are uninsured or underinsured. That's almost all of them.
That's just, you need to just sort of pause after you hear that and say, how could that be?
Something is terribly, terribly wrong. And we've let the market work its magic, which it will do. But the only way it can stay profitable is if it takes on less risk and pass costs on to the patient, leaving the patient vulnerable to financial ruin.
This is supposed to be a care business, right? Health
care. No, it's not, though. See, that's, it is not. In the last decade or so, originally the health insurance industry was largely a nonprofit industry, starting off with the Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans, which still insured the majority of the private insured population. But over the last decade, in order to compete with the commercial plans, most of these nonprofit health plans have converted to for-profit status, and they answer to shareholders, not to their communities. And this is a real dilemma because we have allowed our hospitals, our healthcare, and our entire healthcare system to move to a for-profit status,
right,
which is not the mission of those companies, is not to help people. It's to make money.
Let's take phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. The number is 800-486-8655. Dr. Helen Halpin is our guest, and she is director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Halpin has been with us many times before to talk about the healthcare system, and we are specifically looking at a study released today, and it looks at the number of Americans, 1 out of every 5 adults younger than 65, 25 million Americans with financial hardship, with health insurance rather, did not have sufficient coverage last year to shield them from financial hardship if they happened to be in the emergency room or were seriously ill. And she gives this remarkable statistic, Dr. Halpin, that 72% of adults with incomes of $40,000 or less are either uninsured or underinsured. To you in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Helen Halpin is our guest, Director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Jeff from Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning. Last time I saw any figures, the national yearly bill for medical care in America, in the U.S., was $1.3 trillion, of which $300 million went to HMOs and insurance companies. Now, we have in force, and I'm a beneficiary, as is my wife, of a single-payer Medicare and Medicaid system. And I'll tell you, for us, it works like a charm. The problem basically simplified is that health care is the issue. Insurance itself is the problem because the insurers charging ridiculous premiums and insurance companies hiring doctors and paying them bonuses for withholding treatment could be gotten rid of if, one, we got rid of the lies about the Canadian system, which is not socialized medicine. Every doctor in Canada who wants to be part of the system, the single-payer system, must establish her own practice. That's not socialism. Discussion of health care is merely prolonging the misery. We need to get an expansion universal and cut out the insurance companies and the HMOs because they are the real problem.
Well, I think they definitely are part of the problem. I would agree with you there. The question is how we, and I think many people would agree with you that a single-payer system is probably the most equitable, the most efficient, the most effective way to deliver care. I mean, we can understand that looking around the globe. The question is, how do we move from this voluntary for-profit system that we have right now to one that would achieve the goals of that you're talking about for a universal health care system? I think that if you look at the plans that the Democratic candidates have put forward, and believe me, I think very few people have gone to the websites to read in detail these plans. But the beauty of them all is they do offer a mechanism for a voluntary transition towards a single-payer system. And just speaking specifically about the Obama plan, if you work for a small employer, if you buy in the individual market, if you're uninsured, if you have lousy coverage, you can go into a pool. And in the pool, you'll have two options. You can choose from among the health insurance companies that you're talking about, and many people may prefer to continue to get their care through an HMO. I know here in California, Kaiser is extremely popular, and one out of every three people in the state is in it, and it gets the highest satisfaction ratings in the state. So I don't think we want a blanket policy that says cut out all of them, because some of them do a fairly decent job, and you still want to give people the choice. But the really cool thing about this plan is if you don't want to do that, you can go into a public plan like Medicare, where you can go to any doctor or hospital you want, and there's no insurance company making decisions or looking over the doctor's shoulders, returning care decisions to healthcare practitioners. And this hasn't gotten a lot of play, but it is a very, very important part of the Democratic strategy moving forward, so that those Americans who want to go into a single-payer system will have that option, but it doesn't force it on everyone. Hopefully, that could help balance the strong reaction and overwhelmingly powerful resistance that the for-profit industry would push back if we tried to transition overnight. We can't put the insurance companies out of business overnight. It would be a disaster for the economy. Thousands and thousands of people would lose their jobs. And actually, some of the functions that they perform are really important. I think many Americans aren't aware that, in fact, Blue Cross and Blue Shield still does the majority of the claims processing for the Medicare program for the elderly. And so I think the insurance companies can play an important role going forward, but what I think we'd like them to do is perform administrative functions and get out of the business of selling inadequate insurance policies.
Yeah. Well, they're going to fight that tooth and nail, right?
Of course they'll fight it, but at least it allows them to continue to sell their products within the confines of this pool. It doesn't put them completely out of business, and it also would hopefully provide an increased role for administrative functions, which can be quite lucrative. I think Ross Perot literally made his billions processing Medicare claims.
Really?
He charged the government $1 a claim, which was a real bargain for the government, and he made billions of dollars.
Huh.
So I think we really need to sort of rethink all of this and try to take into account the needs of the various sectors and parties and see if we can't come up with a solution that is more or less a win-win without putting undue burden on any one sector.
Jeff, thanks so much for your call. Dan from Milwaukee, hi.
Hello. I'm retired military, and I've got TRICARE, so I'm just as good as military, and it works wonderful. my partner is in the medical industry. He's an OTR, which you would think that being in the medical industry, you'd have good insurance. Oh, my gosh, is that such a falsehood?
Hmm.
It's just terrible. He wasn't feeling good one day, so he went to the doctor. The doctor thought he was having a heart attack. The doctor called an ambulance to have him taken to the hospital, and his insurance company did not want to cover the $800 ambulance fee because it was the wrong ambulance.
It was the wrong ambulance.
Yeah, it wasn't in their policy.
Oh my gosh!
So, like, you have a choice when you're having a heart attack or an accident of what ambulance comes to pick you up.
Right.
And it took a year to get them to finally pay it.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely nuts. You, if you're having a heart attack, you shouldn't have to call and find out which ambulance company you have.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Time is precious. Oh, Dan, thanks so much for your call. Suzanne is next from Viroqua. Hi, Suzanne.
Oh, hi. I have two comments. First of all, I had to file for bankruptcy because of medical. And at the time, I had just lost a high-paying job. And we had insurance, but it was a high deductible. And now my husband and I are self-employed, and we have a $10,000 deductible.
Oh, my God.
But that is really all we can afford right now. And the other thing, a good friend of mine owns an insurance company in the area. And he, in the past 5 years, has built two $10 million homes. And while I am out there filing for bankruptcy, here he is. I mean, and I wish everybody the best of luck and to make money and everything, but it really makes me sick that I had to go through that, and I'm still living with that shame that I had to do that because I believe in paying my bills.
Right.
And I had no other option.
Oh, sorry. I have never heard of anyone having a $10,000 deductible. See, I don't think that should be legal, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've got to start to regulate this industry. The problem is, though, if we told them you can't have a deductible, let's say, more than $2,000 or $2,500, then there wouldn't be a policy that you could afford to buy. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place right now in this marketplace. Because for you to be able to have affordable coverage, you have this ridiculous deductible. Now, I mean, relative to the total cost of care that you could have, I mean, if you had a very serious illness, you could, you know, it could cost millions. So that this $10,000 would be relatively small to the compared to the total cost. But still, this is just not this is not health insurance.
No, it's just not right, and something has to be done. And I don't know what, but I just wanted to
I'm so
give
sorry
you my comments.
For you. Good luck.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Okay, stay well.
Really.
Bye.
Thanks. Doyle from Saukville. Hi, Doyle.
Hi. Well, I appreciate having a chance to talk on the subject of health care. I think most people are curious if we went to universal health care, how it would work and how much it would cost, because we all know it's not going to be free. And I think if we take a look at Medicare, would be a good glimpse into how we might expect universal health care to work. When 1964, I think it was, we started Medicare, and it covered virtually all health expenses, and every year since then, or almost every year, the deductible's gone up, the copay's gone up, and the people who have Medicare usually find it necessary to buy a health insurance policy to supplement that, and I don't see that we even are actuarially sound with Medicare, with Medicaid, with Social Security. And I think if we take on universal health care, we're taking on a very serious commitment when we haven't even covered the commitments we've already made.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with the Medicare program, which, you know, the costs obviously since its inception have exceeded what everyone anticipated, is that they built the benefit design into law. And so we've been kind of stuck with a 1965 benefits package. You know, it was only, 2 years ago that we added drug coverage. There still isn't long-term care coverage. The preventive coverage has been added painfully slowly. And I think one of the lessons from Medicare is you don't legislate the benefit design. I mean, it seems to me that we're going to need some kind of independent authority that can actually look at the evidence base and where we get the most value from our health care dollars and put together what's currently being called a value-based benefit design, so that you make sure everyone has coverage for those things that we know actually improve your health, and be much more rigorous about evaluating what it is that we pay for everyone. And I think that will help part of the problem. I think the other thing is with Medicare, it's entirely publicly financed. And again, I think that is, you know, through our payroll taxes. I think that is somewhat an outdated and unsustainable model. And I think what most people are talking about right now is about a shared responsibility way of financing health care, so that employers would contribute a certain percentage, individuals would contribute a percentage based on their income, and only what they could afford, and that we'd use a variety of financing mechanisms that hopefully would be more sustainable and affordable for all parties. Here in California, one of the mechanisms was to even have the hospitals pay a small, I think it was 2% or 4% fee on their revenues towards insurance, with the understanding that once everyone has coverage, they don't have any more bad debt. Everyone's care is going to be paid for, and so they're going to benefit enormously from that. And to have them share that increased revenue stream to the benefit of the general population. So again, I think there's a lot more creative financing, and we've learned a lot in the 43 years since Medicare was enacted, and hopefully a lot of that would be applied. The problem with Medicare is that it's just kind of stuck in law, and the Congress has to act to change anything, making it a very difficult program to adjust to current circumstances.
Thanks very much for the call. Email Aaron from Green Bay. When you talked about 70% of those making less than $40,000 not insured or underinsured, how is, and I think we've said this, but we'll say it again, how is underinsured defined? Also, how is financial hardship defined? I think without these definitions, these statistics don't mean much.
Well, so what it would mean for a family under $40,000 that they were spending 10% or more of their total income, so that would be for a family of $40,000 that they're spending $4,000 or more in 1 year out of their own pocket on medical care. Or they have a deductible for a family of $40,000, they have a deductible of $2,000 or more, which would be 5% of their income.
Mm-hmm.
So for that family, anyone who exceeded a $2,000 deductible, like this woman who just called and had a $10,000 deductible,
right,
or people whose costs exceeded $4,000 a year for a family with $40,000, they would be considered underinsured.
Right. We go to Alan from Oshkosh. Hello, Alan.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Morning.
I think one thing we're missing is that when you get over 60 years of age, those premiums really spike up. I now, I'm self-employed, and I pay about $1,800 a month for my premiums.
Whew.
And I have a $5,000 deductible.
Oh.
If my wife and I get sick in the same year, that'll be $10,000, the deductible. They weren't that high, but now they are going up. The premiums are going up approximately 10% every 6 months.
Oh, my God.
And they will tell you, an insurance company will tell you, if you look for other insurance, if you're over 60, nobody will take you. So So that insurance company that has you can do whatever it wants. They can raise the rates however they want.
You know, it's very interesting. I really appreciate your call, because one of the findings in this study, they're sort of buried in there, is that the people who are affected in terms of being uninsured, is that they're a different group than the underinsured. We always hear about the 19 to 29-year-olds being the highest, the group with the greatest uninsurance. But the group with the greatest underinsurance is, in fact, 50 to 64-year-olds, exactly who you're talking about. And I think you're right. I think once you get up into this pre-retirement age, where you're much more likely to have a chronic condition or even multiple chronic conditions, all of a sudden we see this group becoming extremely vulnerable for high out-of-pocket medical costs and being included in this group of underinsured. Almost 40% of the population between age 50 and 64 is considered underinsured. That's a huge number.
Yes, it is. It is a huge number. Alan, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
We go to Dome, is it, from Wisconsin Rapids?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wasn't going to call in, but this program, as usual, is pretty interesting. I'm basically from India, and I guess we go back and forth every couple of years. And my wife is being treated for being a mildly diabetic patient. And for the last, like, 5-6 years, I totaled my bill. It's about, maybe my contribution is about $5,000, something like that. My deductible and all of that put together. When we went out there in India, they said, well, we could do this treatment. It's going to probably take you a couple of years to do this, and it'll cost you about $500.
Wow.
And I just don't understand. I mean, maybe I have a plan through my company. It's a nonprofit insurance company, so they're not for profit. The premiums go up and down. They spike up and down because based on, you know, changes in rates and stuff like that. But there looks like it's the Cadillac of the system because of the fact that they're nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
My question to your guest is, you know, has she had a chance to compare system to system between, you know, countries in Asia and the European and American, you know, in America, to see why it is that, you know, we're paying so much premium on that? And my guess would be because the politicians are in the pocket of the insurance companies, and they don't want to do anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could phrase that differently. They have allowed the insurance companies to go for profit, and they're not going to, you know, they're not going to mess with them. They're going to let them do their business. I mean, they've tried to do some regulation, but it's always been very, very weak. I mean, the main difference, we have a very inefficient system here. First of all, we have no controls on the costs, and many other countries have some sort of global budget or prices can only go up. They're regulated, linked to inflation. We have nothing like that here. Prices go up, and that cost gets passed on through raised premiums and higher cost sharing. So there's no breaks on this system. And the other problem is that we have huge amounts of administrative costs. Because there's no central system where we can purchase, you know, bulk purchase drugs or bulk purchase medical equipment, we don't have any of those savings. We have hundreds of insurance companies, all who are writing different policies, and it is an administrative nightmare. I mean, in a doctor's office right now, you have to hire several staff just to process your claims. This is nuts. In other countries, you go to the doctor, you get your care, you might have a small copay, and that's the end of it, and they submit the bill or they're paid directly from one source, and there aren't all these hundreds of middlemen. I mean, the estimates are that anywhere between 20 to 30% of what we're spending right now is going simply to duplicative administrative costs.
Oh, my gosh.
If we cut that out under a single-payer system there, and we just said we're spending the amount of money that we have now, there's more than enough money in the system right now to offer everyone comprehensive coverage. But we're spending such a huge proportion of it on indirect costs, not directly on medical care, that our costs are actually twice as high sometimes three times as high as countries that cover everyone with full protection.
Hmm. Can you explain to me, Dr. Halpin, how it is that we have this crazy system in this country, which isn't what the world has for the most part, where it's a for-profit system and it's healthcare we're talking about,
right,
which seems to me as though it's perfectly okay for the government to ensure that people are healthy and have access to good doctors and good medical care.
Right. Well, it's a accident of history. If we look back to see when many of the, particularly the European countries, were moving to universal coverage, first of all, they had a much longer and deeper history of social insurance, which we did not have. And what happened on the eve of the Great Depression in this country is hospitals were having terrible cash flow problems. And there was a very creative guy in Baylor, Texas, who got the bright idea of, hey, let's go to the school teachers who are mostly young, healthy young women. The only cost they're likely to have are a pregnancy. And let's offer them up to 30 days of hospitalization over each year at a cost of 50 cents per month per person. And the school system bought into this, and this immediately solved the hospital's cash flow problem because they were getting these premium payments every month from all the teachers and had a steady stream of revenue, and the teachers were relatively healthy and hardly ever used the care. And this model spread, and it was adopted by hospital associations all over the country, and those became the first Blue Cross plans.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yes, and so that's how Blue Cross formed, and they were nonprofit, community-based, run pretty much by the hospital association in each state. The physicians decided, hey, we want to get in on this, because the hospitals were only insuring for the costs of the hospital care. Physicians are paid independently, even physicians who work in hospitals. So the medical associations started offering their own coverage for the cost of physician care in hospitals. It didn't cover any outpatient care, no primary care, no preventive care, but the cost of physician care in hospitals. And those eventually became Blue Shield plans. And then in most states, California is the only exception, Blue Cross and Blue Shield merged to form comprehensive hospital coverage. And in fact, it was based on the hospital coverage model of Blue Cross and Blue Shield that Medicare was defined. The idea was, let's give the elderly the same benefits that the employed are getting. And in 1965, that was primarily Blue Cross Blue Shield hospital coverage. And so we had, then we had the government, and when in World War II came in and froze wages and prices, and so but allowed companies to deduct the expense for health insurance from as part of their costs. And so this became a huge incentive for employers. It became a way for them to attract workers, to retrain workers, and they could deduct this as a cost of doing business. And so this voluntary, nonprofit health insurance system spread like wildfire in the 40s and the 50s. And by the time, you know, we were in the late 50s, the vast majority of working Americans had health insurance coverage through their jobs. And so that when it was time for Medicaid and Medicare, they plugged the hole. Who didn't have an employment link? The elderly didn't have an employment link anymore when they're retired, so they got Medicare.
Right.
And the people on cash assistance welfare didn't have an employment link, and they got Medicaid. And that's how we started. It's a path different than any other country. And then when, you know, when the commercial insurers also came in, the nonprofits were trying to compete with the commercials, and they eventually decided in order to continue to be competitive, they needed to go for profit too. And we saw this rapid conversion all across the country, with very few states really paying much attention. And now all of a sudden we find ourselves with this employer-based system, which the employers increasingly find way too expensive, passing costs on to individuals who are finding it too expensive, and we're in a crisis.
Right. What a fascinating history. I never knew that. I'm glad I asked you.
Oh, thanks.
It's quite a story.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Let's
pause for a moment and we'll return. Dr. Helen Halpin is our guest, director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. We're talking about a study just released yesterday, and it will be published by the Medical Policy Journal, Health Affairs, and it's looking at the number of underinsured Americans. The numbers are truly alarming. Two more phone calls in a moment. Thanks, Dome, for your call. The one line is open at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now, and let's go to Susie from Troma next. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two things I'd like to speak with the doctor about. The first thing was when the lady was on recently talking about her $10,000 deductible. Boy, that's really common in our area. As a matter of fact, even higher deductibles. We were just talking about this at work. I work for a business that employs many part-time employees. And if we take our insurance through our business as a part-time employee, it's $800 a month for the family plan. And many of the people I work with are the working poor and can't afford this. So they go and buy their own insurance, and thank God for Badger Care for the kids, you know. But one of my best friends at work pays $300. We're just talking about this, $300 a month with an $11,000 deductible.
Ooh.
And that was, like, common. But the other thing I want, there's two things I want, two more things I wanted to say. I'm a very healthy person, and we have insurance through my husband's company with very good insurance. But about 10 years ago, I had filed a claim. I had gone to the doctor for strep throat or something like this, and we had done all of our filing and everything and came back, and it was denied. And we couldn't figure out what was going on, so after investigation, this insurance company had actually written me off of my husband's policy because I hadn't had a claim for over 4 years, and they thought I had died.
Oh, my goodness.
We were like, what? You know, it was like, what's going on? Well, no, they said you hadn't had a claim for, you know, 4 or 5 years, so we just automatically thought you were dead. And this was that big company that she was just recently talking about.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Huh. So
they might want to check on things like
right.
that. I want to check on things like that if you're a healthy person. But getting back to being a healthy person, last year I developed a teeny, weeny, weeny speck of skin cancer on my nose and had a Mohs surgery and had it taken care of, and everything was fine and dandy. And then at work here again, we're talking about this, and my friend who pays the has $11,000 deductible said to me, "You will never be insured again." And I said, "But I'm very, very healthy. I mean, it's just a joke when I go to the doctor because I'm so healthy." Mm. And so I started calling around, and there is no company that will insure me. And I said, "I have excellent blood pressure. I don't have this. I don't have that."
They don't care.
Any excuse. I was dead. I was so healthy. And so I went back to my doctor, and she was furious. And she said, "I'm Norwegian." And she said 85 to 90% of the Norwegians, especially in Wisconsin, will develop this form of skin cancer.
Was it the basal cell?
Yep.
Yeah.
It was so teeny. I tell people, if you take your computer and put it on the 12 font, you know, and you just type that teeny weeny little O, it was smaller than that. But now I'm uninsurable. And I've had less than $20,000 in claims. And so what's your answer?
Don't try to make sense out of it.
Right.
They are in the business to avoid risk.
Right.
And they perceive you now as having risk, no matter how small.
I mean, isn't this a crazy system? They should be in the business to take care of people who are sick. That's
right. No, it's completely upside down.
Right.
It
right.
doesn't emphasize prevention.
Right.
And it won't take care of you if you're sick.
Right.
That's why I say don't try to figure it out, because it doesn't make sense. It only makes sense from a business perspective. It does not make sense from a public health perspective.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't.
And unfortunately, health is not the mission of these companies. And for my money, that's why I feel it is so important that we have some sort of federal solution where the goals are not just to make care affordable and to make it accessible, but also to make sure that it protects the public's health.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Susie, for the call. And let us go next to Darlene from Viola. Hi, Darlene.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. I just have a couple of comments. I'm livid beyond words with regards to what I call health crisis care, not health care. There is too much money, which equals the word power, to make the system fair for everybody. There's no president, no matter what they promise to do, that will be able to change the system, because there are too many pockets being lined by lobbyists who have tremendous amount of power. In my own particular circumstance, our premiums go up about 25% a year. They're now over $12,000 a year. We have an $8,000 deductible. I am a healthcare professional. My husband's self-employed, and I work only part-time, very limited part-time. It's hopeless. I really feel that Americans are too apathetic to force the government to make any kind of a change. They're either too apathetic or too scared to revolt to make the needs known. I mean, this has been talked about for at least 10 years, and nothing has ever changed because there's too much power and money involved. And I just really feel that it's hopeless. One very quick example of the absurdity of the charges that are incurred by certain people. I have a friend who has to have a particular injection every couple of months. It costs $3,000 for this injection. There's no way that this is justifiable. And those are my comments. Because
thank you. And your situation is outrageous. I've never heard numbers like these before, and this is one of the reasons I love to do these programs, because we look at the statistics, which are the averages, but on programs like this, we hear from real people who are struggling with problems that are so much larger than the data would suggest, and I think it's really important to get these stories out, and I will be bringing this information and sharing it far and wide, because the situation is so much more dire than even these staggering numbers suggest.
Right.
So thank you for your call.
Yeah. Here's another email. It's a little longer than I can read, but a woman who's a cancer patient who can't get insurance coverage and who, because of a divorce, went from having Cadillac coverage to Title 19 because healthcare providers of all types don't have to accept or do not want to accept Title 19. My access to healthcare is severely limited, and what I do have access to can best be described as substandard.
Well, I think this is a problem. I guess she's on Medicaid. And, you know, the problem, Medicaid actually has one of the most comprehensive benefit packages, but the rates at which they pay physicians and hospitals is staggeringly low.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, it doesn't even begin to cover the provider's cost of delivering the care. So I think in many areas we see extremely limited access because there aren't doctors who will accept these payments. I think everyone understands that when we reform this system, there's got to be equitable pay for providers across these different payers, because it doesn't make sense for a doctor to be underpaid for one patient and then overpaid for another patient. A service should have a price attached to it, and everyone, you know, every physician should get that price. It's grossly inequitable. So here you've offered these folks who have no place else to turn insurance coverage, and it is very comprehensive. There's no deductible. There's very little to no cost sharing. The benefit package is rich. It's the only benefit package that covers long-term care, and yet you can't find a doctor who's willing to accept it. It's like a big tease.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Suzanne. Time is running short. A minute left, everybody. Hi, Suzanne from Oshkosh.
Hi. I know that you're at the very end of your program. I just wanted to thank you for the program today. You've done a lot to explain to me what I call the lethal trifecta in our country of healthcare, economy, and education. I think I understand a little bit better now how it got that way. And I'll just be brief here and ask you, you've said that the solution lies with the federal government. Do you have any more specific ideas about how we can, as a people, as Americans, pull ourselves out of this situation that at least on the bright side we've now identified?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think number one, we need to define access to health care as a right, a human right in this country. And we have never done that. And I think it's critical. And once we start from that as the foundation, then I think we're in a position to seriously look at the problems and find a way, as one of the callers said, there's more than enough money in this current system to provide everyone with the care they need. And the question is, how do we transition from where we are now to where we want to be? And I think, I really do think that the proposals that have been set forth by the Democratic candidates this year, which would provide subsidies to everyone who needed it, and
5 seconds.
Subsidies, and that guarantees that anyone who wants coverage can have it, can afford it, and we fix this payment to providers, and we finance the training of more primary care for providers so that everyone has access.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. We are out of time. Thanks, Dr. Halpin. Always a pleasure. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. John Anderson for on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow.